Good evening. Hello, everyone. Welcome to tonight's edition of the Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture Series. It's great to see some new faces amongst some regulars. And for those of you that are new to our organization, we have been in activity for 30 years or so. Probably only Bob Berman, who's not here tonight, knows exactly how long we've been going on. But our primary activity is a twice a month during the academic year lecture series, which is on second and fourth Tuesdays. Maybe somebody can talk to the restaurant to get
there. Yes.
We are, unlike some other organizations that you might be familiar with, in that we don't promote any particular worldview or perspective or orientation. There are a lot of organizations that do that. We're called the Forum because it's just that. It's a forum for people presenting all kinds of different ways of looking at the world to present, and for us to ask questions and to learn more about it. So it'll be two parts. It'll be a lecture part, and then there'll be a question and answer part. And I will moderate and recognize questioners, and we'd like to keep the questions respectful. Probing is okay in the intellectual sense, but not ad hominem, as us philosophers say, no attacks. Inquiry into understanding the presentation, and we'll try to give everybody a chance to ask the question before we let anybody double up. We are an all-volunteer, nonprofit organization, but we do have expenses of equipment and printing and publication and website and so forth. And so we do take up a $5 admission fee for the lecture, or $2 if you're an enrolled student. And Dr. Alcock back there will take your admission fee on the way out if you didn't manage to pay on the way in. And the meal is between you and El Phoenix, but be sure and settle up with them. I think they're including the tip in there. I was going to say be generous, but they're not. Okay. So please remember your wait staff. They work hard and treat them nicely. We have off and on had a summer event, and we are in the midst of planning one. And Dr. Alcock, do you want to say something about that?
David's been in charge of summer programs in the past, and we skipped last summer, but this summer we're planning a very exciting one. We're going to have Philosopher's Jeopardy, and we have invited three academic programs, possibly four, SMU, UTA, TCU, and possibly University of Dallas, right?
We're working on that.
And there'll be those teams, and they're going to compete, and they're going to answer philosophy questions posed by our astute moderator. And we're going to have cash prizes and that they can donate to the that we will donate to the academic institution. So, in order to raise money for that, we are asking for donations, and they'll be in the form of kind of an advertising on the back of the program. So if you have a business, a profession, or something, or if you just want to donate some money, they'll be in a couple of $100 ones, some $50 ones, and some $20, just for your name as a donation. So we do appreciate that, and it's a nonprofit. We're going to give the money to the institution, so we are asking for sponsors. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dave. Also, check the website, or there should be a few schedules around if you want to check future topics. Tonight, we're delighted to have Jeffrey Manzi, who is a PhD candidate at University of Dallas. Jeffrey received his bachelor's degree from Assumption College in Western Mass and then went all the way to the other end of the continent to Loyola Marymount for his master's degree, and now decided to come back to the center to University of Dallas to complete his PhD. And he'll be presenting to us tonight on the very interesting-sounding topic at the crossroads of freedom and facticity, ambiguity in Simone de Beauvoir. So, Jeffrey.
My mic?
You're on.
Well, guys, first I want to say thanks so much for having me. I must confess I was not aware of this forum prior to a few months ago when Rob Olson, I believe, contacted me, and I was very encouraged when I heard about it. It seems like the kind of thing that there needs to be more of. So like I said, I'm really thrilled with the opportunity, and I'm quite happy to speak with you guys. Now, again, yeah, at the crossroads of freedom and facticity, ambiguity, and Simone de Beauvoir, I was asked by Rob Olson to present on something that's specifically postmodern, and that is kind of a controversial issue in philosophy, I suppose. It's very 20th century, 21st century. And I presented him with this topic, ambiguity in Beauvoir. I mean, just out of curiosity, does anybody have any even relative familiarity with maybe existentialism? Or something along those lines. Oh, that's terrific. Oh, fantastic. All right, cool. Well, I wasn't exactly sure how much context to go into, but it did occur to me today that before I kind of launch into the nitty-gritty of my presentation, it might be helpful to just kind of clarify some terms to couch her notion of ambiguity in a way that seems, I suppose, relevant. Or another way to put it might be her place in the tradition, in the history of philosophy. Now, of course, in order to do that, I have to talk about her predecessors just briefly. So here are some of her predecessors. You have a man named Martin Heidegger. He wrote a book called Being in Time. Philosophically speaking, I believe it's safe to say that this is the most important work of the 20th century. And by that I mean it's had the biggest influence on philosophy's trajectory since its publication. So anybody who came after this book has had to talk about this book. So I'll say a couple of things about the terms such as facticity come from this book, as Beauvoir will be talking about, as I'll be presenting it. And then, of course, this man was referenced in the, I guess, in the preface here, in the abstract. Anybody get a chance to read the abstract?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, great, cool. Yeah, this is Jean-Paul Sartre. This is Beauvoir's, I guess we'll call him best friend, for a very long time.
Benefits
for
I'm sorry.
No, please. Gosh. No, I mean, their past is rather compelling in a lot of ways. We'll put it like that. Yeah, he wrote a book called Being and Nothingness.
Oh.
It's a response to Being and Time. So again, he is dialoguing, Sartre is dialoguing with Heidegger. And then we have Simone de Beauvoir, who is dialoguing with the both of them. Now, again, I did say that these postmodern thinkers, these kind of Frenchy thinkers, they're really, they like to push the envelope. So Beauvoir, for example, she is what you'd call atheist. She doesn't believe in God, and she has certain, I guess, in her mind, compelling reasons for thinking that. Most existentialists, most what are called kind of these European philosophers, they go that way, they lean that way. There are some exceptions, of course, but she's not one of them. She's probably most known for writing this, The Second Sex. Anybody familiar with this one? Yes, it was, it's often referred to as the feminist's Bible. Now, listen, I'm not going to be talking about this book tonight, so... But it is worth mentioning that she proves, I don't want to say proves, maybe that's too strong a term, but she provides an argument for this position, this kind of feminist position, in a way that's strictly philosophical. And so there's a degree of respect you have to offer her for that reason. It's not a lot of ramping and raving or anything like that. It's very well thought out, well argued. And it's also worth selling. This was the equivalent to a New York Times bestseller. I mean, everybody in at the time in France and Europe, really, Western Europe, had a copy of this on their coffee table. So it was. These aren't necessarily kind of abstract, really removed to the fringes of popular culture works here. These were talked about works. The work I'm going to be focusing on is this little tiny book called The Ethics of Ambiguity. Now, this is why I like Beauvoir so much, is because she's, I would argue, the only existentialist thinker that puts forth an ethics that believes in good and evil. She gives those terms weight, and a lot of her predecessors don't. You don't really see it in Heidegger or Sartre, but you see it here. And so what we'll be talking about today is precisely her notion of ambiguity, which is to say the middle ground, the kind of living paradox that is a human being, as she understands it. So we'll be looking at some passages in here that are might be tough to swallow, but I say let's hear it out. At least we can do. Okay. Were there any questions, just out of curiosity, on my abstract? Anything you wanted to clarify before we kind of push ahead here? If anybody wants to take a closer look at these, you can pass them around. It's up to you guys. You good? Want to hang on every word? That's cool. Okay. I do, yes. Yeah. Well, thank you.
You won't give it back.
After an endorsement like that, I'm surprised nobody wanted to at least take a look at it. Okay, well, a couple of things here. Let's like I said, provide some context. And I am, my Achilles heel is time management, so I'm going to try to push things along here. It doesn't always work out like that.
That's a light if you need to use it.
Oh, I'm fine. This is okay. Nice to thank you. Okay, the first thing I want to talk about, and this will be important for understanding Beauvoir in kind of an in-depth way, is the distinction between choice and deliberation. A choice and a decision are not the same thing for Jean-Paul Sartre. And again, Beauvoir is going to pick up on this. So you hear words like, and this tied into the freedom aspect, you hear words like choice, decision, versus, again, you see something like facticity, you think determinism, you think necessary, antithetical to freedom. And you often see these in free will versus determinism debates, or free will versus divine foreknowledge debates that have occurred throughout the history of philosophy. That's not what we mean here. That's not what Sartre means here. He wants to say that the big difference between, say, choosing and deciding is the cognitive element, the sitting back and considering element. He believes that choice is implicit, which is to say it's not something you think about. It's not something you deliberate, you dwell on. You weigh the options. Again, the cognitive aspect of things. It's natural. It kind of just happens in the moment. I mean, so for example, how you're sitting right now. Did you sit back and go, well, how do I want to sit back right now while this guy's talking? Do I want to put my arm like this? Do I want to lean back like that? You know, you just kind of take a seat, right? You just kind of position yourself in such a way without thinking about it. That's what choice is. That's what he thinks choosing is. Now, you could have sat one way rather than another, so there is an element of selection involved. So he calls it choice, right? But it's not something you sat back and considered. Deliberation is what he calls doing that. When you actually have to, when you think about it. He has kind of a relatively famous quote that says, When the human person deliberates, it's when the chips are down. In other words, when there's some sort of problem or issue or difficulty, that's when you would, quote, deliberate. That's when you have to decide, make a decision. Choice is something that you just do almost unconsciously, almost naturally. It's part of kind of who you are in your default center. Sartre has an example of this in his book, Being and Nothingness. And, you know, I wasn't sure whether or not to bring it up, but it involves hiking. And I think there are some fans of hiking here, as I learned briefly just a moment ago. So I'll bring it up. It's in the very last part of this book here. Jean Paul Sartre's Being Nothingness. This is a big book, obviously. It's no light reading. And so, seriously, and so this distinction, it occurs almost at the end. So a lot of people don't really make it that far. It took me a few excursions before I made it to the end. But that's where all the good stuff is. That's where the upshot is. So I have the passage right here, and I'll just briefly read it. Okay, he's discussing a person, on a hike who gets tired. Well, let me ask, has anybody ever been on a hike?
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's great. So maybe you can relate to this. I've been on 2 hikes in my life. Both very difficult. I mean, this really spoke to me. And so I'll just read it very, very briefly. There's a few sentences. Kind of goes on with it, but... Okay, so he says, common opinion does not hold that to be free means only to choose oneself. A choice is said to be free if it is such that it could have been other than what it is. You could be sitting a different way, but you're not. You're sitting this way. You're wearing these clothes. You're probably maybe daydreaming about this thing. You know, any number of things like that. I start out on a hike with friends. At the end of several hours of walking, my fatigue increases and finally becomes very painful. At first I resist, and then suddenly I let myself go. I give up. I throw down my knapsack on the side of the road and let myself fall down beside it, collapse. Someone will reproach me for my act and will mean thereby that I was free. That is, not only was my act not determined by anything or person, but also I could have succeeded in resisting my fatigue longer. I could have done as my companions did and reached the resting place before relaxing. And I hung with that. I shall defend myself, the fatigued guy, by saying that I was too tired. And so, again, who is right? This example gets at what I'll be talking about in greater detail here. So his friends are saying, come on, get up, you wimp. You said you were on the hike with us. The resting place is just 100 yards over there. You can do it. And in them calling him out on it, the friends are kind of, the implication is that regardless of your body, regardless of how natural forces are really making you feel, you're tired, maybe you're dehydrated, the friends seem to think you could still will yourself. You could still choose to go forward. So there's that freedom that seems to override nature in a certain sense. But then the guy says, no, I'm too tired. Which is to say, even if I wanted to push forward, which I do, I can't. This is the determinism kind of thing. My body, the fact of the matter is, my body's kind of given up here. And so I have no choice but to pass out here, something like that. That's an interesting understanding of choice. Now, Sartre argues that the person, in fact, chooses, in the way that I described earlier, chooses to relinquish himself right then and there. Now, is it completely the body kind of overcoming him, his limitations, taking him over? Probably not. Could he, if he wanted to, push himself and climb another 1,000 feet? In his state, probably not. It's ambiguous. It's somewhere in between. Now, this might sound crazy. But, I mean, consider some alternatives. We mentioned the University of Dallas. I don't know if you guys are aware of the Cowans, but they founded the Braniff Graduate School, the graduate program that I'm a member of. And, you know, they brought philosophy to Irvine, I guess. Something along those lines. And, you know, unfortunately, Donald Cowan, you know, he met his death untimely. But there's a story about him that everybody knows, and it's kind of impressive. He and Louise, his wife, were driving back from a conference, like an 8-hour, 9-hour drive. Now, he had a bad heart problem. And he drove behind the wheel 9 or 10 straight hours, But the second he got into his garage, turned off the car, that's when he suffered a massive heart failure. And so there's something, Sartre says, that's not a coincidence. That, like, in a certain way, whether he knew it or not, it happened at the right time where, you know, it worked out beneficially for Louise, because had it happened, you know, at some other time, it could have been even more tragic. And again, you think of people who run marathons. They give out just after they cross the finish line. And then they say, oh, I couldn't go another step. And Sartre says, well, I bet if you had to go another 20 steps to cross the finish line, you probably could have done that step. So again, there's this odd thing where we don't think about, okay, I'm going to pass out once I park the car or something like that. But it happens that way. And he thinks that's implicit. It's a choice, as opposed to deliberation, which is cognitive. I mean, if we deliberated over every action we did, we would never get anywhere. Okay. Is that clear, more or less?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So I want to keep this distinction in mind, because it will be important. Sartre calls it the phenomenon of abandonment. Again, where you abandon yourself to sleep, or you abandon yourself to fatigue. But again, there's more of an agency there than one might think. Okay, it's more like going with the flow. You know, this is where Sartre takes it. He has, if you've ever been on a date, something like that. If you're sitting with your beloved in a movie theater, I mean, you kind of just go with it. You kind of read the situation such a way where, okay, now it's appropriate for me to maybe hold her hand or something like that, something romantic, a gesture. I mean, unless you're 14, you're not the entire movie thinking, oh my God, now should I hold her hand? Should I make my move now? Should I make my move now? And then, you know, you go for it, and she accepts you, and you go, oh man, I should have done this like an hour ago. Or she pulls it away, and you're like, oh, just reaching for popcorn, I was grabbing my phone. That sort of thing. It's not like that. You go with the moment. If something scary happens in the movie, you instinctively, it seems like, comfort her. So, okay, that's what he's getting at. That's where he takes it. Okay, so there's that. The other key distinction I want to talk about, the other key term, really, is this notion of facticity. And I included it in my title. It's kind of a technical and something of a misleading term. When you hear facticity, it's easy to think, okay, the facts, right? The fact is, for me, I have a body that, you know, I'm 5'7". That's a fact that I wasn't free to change. Maybe nowadays I could get some sort of surgery or just walk around in stilts or something like that. But you think of these things that you can't help. Okay, I was born at this time, this year, this location, to this family. And so it's easy to think, oh, that's what facticity means. But in fact, that's not what it means. Heidegger's term, Beauvoir's term for that is factuality. What are actually the facts? Facticity is how you receive your facts, how you interpret them, what you make of them, what your attitude is in the face of them. That's facticity. There's an interpretive element to it, right? There's a part where you can interpret them differently. If you're disproving of certain aspects, so you know, think of the basketball player who's 5'2" and says, well, I'm 5'2", I can never be a basketball player. And then think of somebody like Muggsy Bogues, or you know what I mean? A basketball player who is, in fact, quite adept in spite of his factuality. So we would say the facticity is he took his limitations and he said, no, it's not going to stop. It's how what he does with them, how you take up your lot in life. That's facticity. And so as we see, freedom and facticity, they're going to be quite related. Because the freedom is precisely how you take up your circumstances that are inherited. And what Beauvoir is going to do is not simply settle on stuff like height, you know, ethnicity or culture or something like that. Or I suppose in this one, again, she focuses on gender. What does it mean to be a woman? If I'm a woman, am I naturally this or that, the other thing? Or could I be something? Really interesting. She puts a lot of the blame on women themselves for their positions. It's an interesting thing. But Beauvoir is going to ask her readership to consider that in light of traditions that we almost seem to think that questioning is not that they're not an option, but that they seem inherited. They seem part of your just basic endowment. Okay. Any questions so far? I know this is kind of, I feel kind of bad. I'm throwing a lot of weird terms at you guys. But it's, all right, fantastic. It's all, I mean, it's all going to, the rubber's going to hit the concrete when I really delve into what I've written here. All right, so I have a couple of just little blurbs here. Again, facticity refers, this is a recap, to how one understands those facts, which is to say how one takes them up. The way in which, in our freedom, we implicitly choose the meanings or significance of situations. I mean, that's the key term for existentialists. Whether or not you're aware of it, is situations. People are always involved with other people, with other things happening in the world. Man does not exist in a vacuum. It's always man in situations. One last thing. Heidegger has this notion that he calls authenticity. And something of a contrasting notion, meaning inauthenticity. What that implies is the following. When you're living authentically, well, I should say this. There's nothing pejorative about inauthenticity. Authenticity means, according to these existentialists here, you're focused on your own life. You're focused on your world, for example. Inauthenticity means your focus is not on you in particular, your subjectivity, your agency, but it's on other people. So right now, you could say, I am being inauthentic. I'm living inauthentically. Because I'm not focusing on me, you know what I mean, my plans, my projects. I'm focusing on everybody here. And thinking about what it would be like to hear a presentation on Beauvoir for maybe the first time. No, my focus is outward. It's external, as opposed to inward or internal. So, you know, if I'm thinking about what I'm going to be doing next summer, you know, maybe I'm not considering going on sabbatical or something like that. That's when I'd be, folks, that's when I'd be authentic. Nothing pejorative about it. Nothing, there's no bad connotation of inauthenticity. It's more a bad translation. You can interpret the facts about your life, either authentically or inauthentically. That's the key. Circumstances are defining, but they're not definitive. I think that's a good way to put it. He talks about lived experience. And this is so key for Beauvoir. Anybody know German? Curiosity? Really? Oh, well, I'm going to embarrass myself in front of you guys. There's a word called Leben or Erlebnis. Maybe you guys have heard of this. Erlebnis is it's a verb. It means living, yeah, or to live, or something along those lines. And then Leben is the word, the noun that is I guess like life itself. And so this term Erlebnis, it gets at, you know, what comes out of living. Like, what do you get? What do you derive from living? And what you get is experience. And so we talk about lived experience. The experience that one accumulates through living. Again, these are existentialists. They're about existing. So there'll be a lot of focus on what it means to exist and how one exists and all that stuff. Okay. Again, we don't usually know what makes our experiences happen in the way it does. There's no question that they do, in fact, happen. And not all of them happen in such a way where we can plan them out. A lot of it is natural. A lot of it is just rolling with the punches. I spent Christmas with my in-laws this past December. I'm married. I'm relatively recently married. My in-laws, they're really... They love Christmas. Like, they celebrate it in such a way where it's not like my family. I mean, it's everybody gathers around the piano and sings Christmas carols, and, you know, the great-grandmother, the matriarch, is there, and she's conducting with a wooden spoon, and, you know, she'll give you a tap if she sees that you're just lip-singing. But afterwards, we watched home videos of Christmas's past, as it were. And I got to watch a video of my future wife, very young at the time, interacted with her sister. She was sitting there, my wife was, Christina, with some sort of cookie, like a Christmas cookie. And her little sister came over, Robin, my sister-in-law. And as soon as Robin sat down, Christina, like I'm very young, she's not cognitive and quite yet, just instinctively, like, hands her some of the cookie. Again, this is what we mean by choice. It's not as if my wife sat there and, like, thought to herself, geez, you know, I kind of want to keep this cookie, but, you know, it is close to Christmas, and Santa Claus probably already finalized his naughty list and nice list, so I might be able to skate away cleanly here. You know, she starts considering stuff like the, you know, the cost-benefit analysis. That's the liberation. But to just naturally give it to her, when she could have otherwise not, that was just a choice. That's lived experience. It just kind of happened like that. There's no kind of, I guess, reputation management, something along those lines. I thought that was fine. No, I was surprised my wife actually was so generous. I told her to get back to her roots. Okay. So I guess the key word is the choice is spontaneous, not cerebral. Deliberation cerebral. I'll give you one last example before we delve into Beauvoir. And this comes from Sartre himself. Sartre gives this funny example, and I already kind of alluded to it, of a woman on a date with a man. Now, the woman doesn't want to ruin the magic of the evening. She's not, it's like a first date. And so she wants to be in the moment, in the present. And yet, you know, the guy, he's kind of like thinking ahead a little bit. So he does something like, not quite make a move, but he leans in closely to her. And that's, there's a little implication perhaps that's involved in that act. And Sartre describes a woman who pretends not to notice. She doesn't want to have to make any decisions, right? Any choice. She just wants to live the experience. She just wants to be a part of the evening. But finally, the moment comes where a guy, he makes his move. He takes her hand. Now she has to choose, right? She has to think to herself, well, okay, what do I do now? Because the implication is clear. If I consent to it, I mean, what happens? There's an implication there that maybe she's not prepared to make. If she pulls it away, it's going to ruin the whole night. And she wants to enjoy the evening. She doesn't want to ruin the magic. But she has to choose, and this is Sartre's point. And you know what she does? She tries to choose by not choosing. So Sartre describes a scenario where she pretends like she doesn't notice. And he describes a woman who gets... She starts to pontificate. She starts to contemplate. She brings up all these very abstract philosophical presuppositions. She's talking about the arts. She's so involved in her conversation, she's not even paying attention. And so the hand just kind of sits there like a wet salami or something. And, you know, the point being that she thinks she has found a way to delay the inevitable choice she'll have to make one way or the other. But Sartre's point is that she doesn't. That in doing so, she's still making a choice. There's no escaping her freedom. I mean, that's the point. Like I said in my abstract here, we're condemned to be free. Human beings, insofar as we're rational, insofar as we have the ability to make choices or make decisions, which is to say, how we live, how we are, there's no escaping our freedom. And that is precisely what I'll be talking about right now, what Beauvoir talks about. It's people who, she's afraid, attempt to evade their freedom. In particularly subtle, yet dangerous ways. Okay, now she's going to call this ambiguity. Alright, freedom and choice are discovered in spontaneous ownership of your actions, the responsibility aspect. She was not owning her situation, she was not owning her choice, she's trying to disown it. And in that way she's being disingenuous. It's examples like that that we'll take a closer look at. Okay, any sort of questions so far before I go forward? That's about as heady as we're going to get in terms of me throwing a lot of different thinkers and ideas at you. We're going to get very specific now. We're going to get very concrete. Yeah, please.
I guess I'm thinking, a quick question.
Yes.
That has always struck me as having a little bit of a compulsive element, compelling element.
Okay.
And I'm thinking is contrasted with sometimes forbearance is a very real and meaningful choice.
Yes. And I see your distinction there, and I appreciate it. A lot of it has to do with, and I'm actually going to more or less get into that. So again, thank you. But a lot of it, as we're going to see, has to do with how one takes up one's factuality. It comes back to that term facticity. How one decides to act in a situation. And the fact of the matter, I mean, here's the irony. The fact is, you are free. It's, they're not necessarily opposed. I mean, they're wedded. They're indelibly intertwined. Okay, so I'm running out of time here. Okay, let me move forward a bit. Okay, so I say De Beauvoir's term for the human condition is ambiguity. Let's get specific here. What does she mean by ambiguity concretely? So she means a bunch of different things at the same time. For one, she says, okay, on the one hand, human beings are bodies. We're objects. We have materialism. Think along those lines. We have physical properties. We are objects entrenched in the world of objects. Yet transcending our objectness, or our object quality, towards an open future. So she wants to say, on the one hand, here's the difference between a human being and, say, something like a chair. Or Sartre's example is the egg, in a certain sense. What you use to make breakfast with. That chair has no possibilities open to itself, right? The chair is not able or capable of doing something with its life. It almost seems silly to even talk like that. It's an object. It is what it is. The human being is most of all what it is not, which is to say, is not yet. The human being is an object. There's no denying it. Again, there's that factuality. I can't will myself to grow another 5 inches, no matter how many times I'm not afraid. But the fact of the matter is that I am still able to change my trajectory whenever I please. I can transcend the fact I'm not just a mere object. I can consider my attitude in the face of limitations and then plot a course for myself where my orientation is on the future. So again, what you are most of all is where you're trying to go. It's kind of the existentialist point here. And so we have this ambiguity between, on one hand, we're an object, as others see you, and yet there's more to us that cannot be discernible. Secondly, we're destined for death. I assume everybody here knows that. And yet we're aware of death now. She wants to say, out of every single entity, only the human being dies but knows it. You know, animals, my dog, I love my dog to death, but he doesn't know he's going to die someday. He doesn't. Animals aren't aware of that, even though it happens to them. And then if you think of something like, think of the ancient Greek gods with Zeus and the like. I mean, they know about death, but they never die. They're eternal. And so in the middle here, you have a human being, this ambiguous thing where it's like, yeah, we know we're going to die. And knowing that knowledge affects what we value, how we choose to live. But all that knowledge doesn't change anything. The fact still remains that death is inevitable. And so again, there's this ambiguity. There's this both. Yes, we're mortal, but being aware of our mortality allows us to actualize a freedom. But it doesn't change the ultimate point. The ultimate end point, I should say. Secondly, and similarly, we're embedded in time, yet conscious of that fact. Yeah, again, think of animals. Think of plants. I mean, they exist in time. But they don't really know it. I mean, you leave your dog alone for 3 hours or 3 days, he's going to greet you the same way when you come home. Doesn't know how much time has passed. Human beings, we are stuck in time. We can't escape it. We can't just step out of it. And yet, that limitation itself can be transcended insofar as, you know, you can think about the future. You can recollect the past. And in that sense, you're kind of risen up from, say, the animal who is incapable really of doing those things. So we're ambiguous, we're temporal creatures, but in a certain way we can transcend this temporality. We're also a unique subjectivity. Yeah, seemingly the center of the world, yet among others who experience themselves the same way. Yeah, so again, there's this both and. Well, I'm an individual, and you are. There's nobody like you ever, and there will never be anybody like you ever again. But that's how it is for everybody. It's like Robert Wood, Bob, he presented to you guys a few months ago. He has this joke he likes to make, where he talks about the psychiatrist and the patient. And the patient is on the couch and says, you know, I'm all alone, I'm isolated, nobody can know my suffering, nobody knows the trouble I've been through. And the psychiatrist goes, yeah, I know what you mean. Well, you see, there's that ambiguity. It's like, is it one or the other? And the point is, no. It's not one or the other, it's both. And so the exercise here is to not think in terms of black and white, of freedom and determinism or something like that. Those two opposites. A human being, as I say, is bipolar. We exist in between these poles of sheer freedom and complete determinism or factuality. Okay. Two more. We're an agent who acts in the world, yet faced with our objectified acts, which others interpret as it suits them. Now, the point being that every time you do something, every time you execute an action, that action becomes an object for others to scrutinize, for others to interpret, maybe consider your motivations, this kind of thing. And yet it's you who freely chose to do it. Mm-hmm. And other people will have differing opinions on that action. So again, it's like you have a life that you're living. You're unique. You're subject. But that life, because it exists in the world, can itself become almost like an object of investigation. But of course, you're more than just that. There's more to you than just an object. And so we have that ambiguity. And then finally, this last part, an object for others as they are for us. Now again, what she's going to say is that you know yourself individually. You're deep, right? This is infinite in here to a certain extent. But not others see you that way all the time. And you don't see others that way all the time either. And it's natural. It's not a bad thing. I mean, familiar with the means versus ends distinction there. I mean, so you can't help, she's going to say, but seeing other people kind of as, not necessarily means, but just you know them in very small ways. So, oh, there's Frank. Yeah, he's my mailman. Well, he's more than just a mailman, right? But you see him, you identify him as your mailman. That's the role he plays in your life story. And that's not a bad thing that you only see him like that. But of course, the kicker is that's how others see you. So Frank the mailman will look at you, and he won't see, oh, a husband, a father of four, these accomplishments, that accomplishments. He's just going to say, oh, he lives at 1632 Irving Boulevard. That's my customer. Okay. But of course, which one are you? Are you one or the other? The answer is you're both. Again, it's ambiguous. So these are the five or six basic ways in which she means ambiguity. Any sort of questions or comments? And if not, I'll launch into what I've actually prepared here. This is a lot of context. I'm guilty of this. Yes, miss. Oh, okay. Oh, they're throwing a hand in there.
I have a comment.
Yeah, please.
I love animals.
Okay, yeah, so.
I tend to disagree with you on the they don't know care. I'm proof of it. I was thrown from my horse yesterday because she was very fearful of something that, you know, appeared to her to be harmful to her. Mm-hmm. So I've always felt, you know, where does their fear come from, Chris, that they're going to be really hurt or die?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. Yeah. I mean, this is why they run. That's why the deer runs or the gazelle runs and the lion chases it. It's afraid. I think what I was more or less getting across was the fact that a dog is not going to write a will or kind of think about what will become of my toys after I die. Will they go to the chihuahua up the street? That would be horrible. it's not affecting, you know, his day-to-day activities like it does human beings, maybe. you know, so some people, if they have a near-death experience or something along those lines, it's going to affect how we live. You know, if my dog has a near-death experience, someone's going to sit by a car, but avoids it. I'm not so sure. I mean, hopefully, you hope it learns, but it's not clear to me that suddenly the dog's going to say, I have to seize the day. Yeah, so that's all I was trying to get at. Yes, sir.
I was going to ask this anyway, and now that you're talking about animals, I watch these documentaries on lions all the time. Mm. Fascinating. And there's one where he's the king, and he's a male in the pride. Mm. And these two young males come in to town, and they take him down. They tear him apart, and he's usually able to defend him. And then in the end, he's like laying in this ditch. And you never saw so much despair.
Yeah.
And he does know he's going to die, but he knows his life is over.
Yeah.
And I someone ought to look into mammalian existentialism. And it's important because otherwise we just have us.
No, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more. I don't want to get off on a sidetrack here, but it is definitely an interesting thought. I mean, I guess I would just say that following in line with most philosophers of the 20th century, no language, no thought. If you don't have language, then you don't properly think. That you need articulation. Things have to take on a form that's that to that degree of sophistication to properly have what we might call thinking. I mean, was the lion having an existential crisis? I don't know. Probably not. But there's certainly an element of awareness of, I'm expiring. So yeah, I would be curious as well to look more into that. You know, grants aren't easy to come by in the name of these things. Believe me. But okay, I'm gonna do a little bit of reading here, and you know, I'll pause every now and then. But you know, what's coming next is gonna be far more eloquent. I guarantee. All right. Okay. So on every side, we find ourselves to be this, yet not this. You know, think of those polarities of ambiguity there. Unstable. Drawn between two poles. What are you? A consciousness? Yes. A body? Yes. Free? Indeed. Conditioned? Of course. Solitary? Yes. Among others? Yes. All of those things, so different from each other, so opposed. One is constantly transcending, going beyond the very being that one is. In other words, one's very existence is ambiguous. Like Kierkegaard, like Heidegger, like Sartre before her, Beauvoir realizes that this status poses problems to the human being. And she agrees that simply constructing a theory cannot solve these problems. Rather, they have to be solved, so to speak, solved by living. In truth, she writes, there is no divorce between life and philosophy. So philosophy isn't some sort of logic game, or you know, you go to philosophy club or something like that, and you talk about these grandiose theories of reality in the afterlife, or something along those lines, the nature of God, and then you just go about your day, and it doesn't have any impact on you. She's saying that, you know, how you live, how you are, that'll tell you what your philosophy really is, regardless of what you might think it is. There's that famous story about Max Scheler. Max Scheler was a philosopher. He was a moral philosopher, in fact. He was famous. He was one of those philosophers that was a pseudo-celebrity in his time. And, you know, his bread and butter was ethics. Then one day, they found Max Scheler's wallet in the couch of a brothel. And they said, Max Scheler, you know, we pay you a lot of money to be a celebrity here in academia and to know more than anybody else in anywhere about ethics and morality. Why were you at a brothel? And Max Scheler says something along the lines of, you know those one-way signs? They don't actually go down that street themselves. So again, he wanted to say, I'm just a sign. Yeah, I can tell you everything you want to know about ethics. The sign doesn't necessarily follow its own direction. Beauvoir would say, that's unacceptable. because there should be no divorce between one's philosophy and one's. Okay. Like them, she is aware too that there are wrong turns that can be taken. Ways of evading the anguish of having to be free. And that suggests a life lived in what Sartre refers to as bad faith. So the woman who pretended not to choose, pretended like there wasn't a situation confronting her, she's what Sartre would call bad faith. She's pretending that she is less than what she really is. She wishes she were just an object and didn't have to choose necessarily. Because here's the thing, again, you know, that famous quote from whatever it was, with great freedom comes great responsibility. If you're free, then you and you alone, your life is on you and you alone. And that's a lot of pressure. And so it's really tempting to try to evade that pressure. And then the anguish that comes after making a decision. Oh my God, why did I fly off the handle like that? Instead of saying, it was my fault, it's a lot easier to say, well, I'm Italian. I got a hot temper. What do you expect? You know what I mean? It's easy to pass it off like that. Because it alleviates one of one's anguish. Okay. Okay, one is taken by the hero of Albert Camus' novel, The Stranger. Let me hear Camus. He's like the existentialist's existentialist. He wrote something, I guess his most famous work is called The Myth of Sisyphus. Where he poses the question, the only question philosophy ought to be concerned itself with is whether or not you ought to commit suicide, whether or not you should kill yourself. That's pretty far out there. He's got his own thing going that Beauvoir's never really mixed up with. But he wrote a story. He wrote fiction and novels as well. One of them is The Stranger. And I want to take a passage from The Stranger we're going to look at here. After killing an Arab on an Algerian beach, almost as though he himself were not involved in it. So the setting is this guy, the stranger, he just kills an Arab. Makes a decision to kill. But he doesn't, the way he describes it, the way he experienced it, the way he took up the facts of what just occurred, what we would call his facticity, reveals itself in the following way. He says, the trigger gave, and the smooth underbelly of the butt jogged my palm. Nothing I think about grammar. I look for subject, verb, object. But he just committed murder. And his way of describing it, what's the subject of the verb? Is it him? The butt of the trigger jogged my palm. He describes it like he had nothing to do, like he wasn't present. Like there was no agency behind the act. This is how he's describing it. Marisol is his name. All right. Marisol is convicted and sentenced to death. A chaplain visits him. Marisol rejects the comforts he is offered and says this. Now this is everything I hear. He says, nothing. Nothing had the least importance. And I knew quite well why. From the dark horizon of my future, a sort of slow, persistent breeze had been blowing toward me all my life long. From the years that were to come. Years that were to come. And on its way, that breeze had leveled out all ideas that people tried to foist on me in the equally unreal years that I then was living through. What difference could they make to me? The deaths of others, or a mother's love, or his God, or the way a man decides to live, the fate he thinks he chooses. We hear in these words the unmistakable voice of nihilism. You guys know what nihilism is? Marisol, this is a novel where the hero, he's very a despicable person. He's a nihilist. And this is one way to resolve ambiguity. Right? The anguish that comes with having uncompromisingly free. Every second of every day you're making choices, or if the chips are down and making decisions, that's a lot to bear. This is one way to tie yourself to avoid it. It's become a nihilist. It's when nothing matters. It's like that, you know, that song. I can't read it. Nothing really matters. It's like that. Queen, Bohemian Rhapsody, yeah. You know, I'm at that age where I think of it, I associate it with Wayne's World. I knew there's probably something else more between them. Okay, so again, this is one way to resolve the ambiguity. Withdraw into your consciousness, observe others passively. Make everything into an object, objectify everything. And when you do that, you create this distance from the world, this detachment. And all importance, all significance, all values flatten out. This is one way to evade that ambiguity. So again, we're talking about the nihilist. Mr. Camus' stranger, Beauvoir says, is right to reject all those ties that others want to impose upon him from without, from outside, from without. He's right to be, if not skeptical, at least question them. No possession is given, but the foreign indifference of the world is not a given either. So this guy tries to say, well, this is how it has to be. Nothing matters. But it doesn't have to be like that. But it's this kind of perverted coping mechanism where it makes life easier, but it drains it of its richness. And you flatten out. You become less a man, more an object. So Marceau is no different than the fly on the wall, or that painting, who sits there, you know, nothing means anything to it. Observes passively life itself. I mean, the painting probably has a pretty stress-free life, though. That's kind of the point. Hopefully that doesn't sound appealing to anybody in this room. She's saying that this view from nowhere is not a privileged point from which the truth about existence can be seen. I mean, again, the truth, as if there were such a thing. Beauvoir doesn't believe in objective truth. But as we're going to see, she believes in objective evil. Rather, it is a vain attempt to evade the ambiguity that we are, so as not to have to live it. Again, lived experience. It is escape, escapism. It is inauthentic or disingenuous. She writes, the nihilist is right in thinking that the world possesses no inherent justification and that he himself is nothing. So she's saying, again, it's postmodern, kind of controversial. She is contending that the stranger is right, that there's nothing 100% objectively true about the world. But that's not a reason to have that kind of reaction. It's a pitiful reaction. He forgets that it is up to him to justify the world and to make himself exist validly. They're following in the steps of, if I say his name out loud, Friedrich Nietzsche.
Yeah.
Nietzsche says the world is valueless. It's meaningless. Which is to say there's no inherent value that you're waiting to, that it's there and you're trying to discover it like buried treasure. Now you've found it and it's yours. The world is indifferent to our existence. But that doesn't mean that you just throw up your hands and say, well, then whatever. It's the opposite. It means that now it's up to you and your freedom, and given the circumstances that you find yourself in, to create meaning. To determine for yourself, to choose for yourself what is valuable, what is worth pursuing. You create the value of the world. It's not there. It's coming from you. This is her point. This is Nietzsche's point. And as you might suspect, they're rather suspicious of large kind of conglomerates that tell you what value is, that tell you what truth is, and to tell you not to ask questions about it. Otherwise, bad things might happen to you. That's what they're concerned about. Okay. Analogous to the nihilists are the cynic, the cynics who disparage everything equally. You know what it means to call somebody cynical? You know what a cynic is? Yeah, very, very pessimistic kind of guy. And the comedian, who makes everything look comical. The humorist. Think of the stand-up comedian, or the satirist, or something along those lines. Beauvoir begins one of her philosophical essays with a story about an ancient king of Epirus in northwest Greece. is a funny little story. See the comedy here. Quickly. Plutarch tells us that one day Plutarch tells us that one day Pyrrhus was devising projects of conquests. "We are going to subjugate Greece first," he was saying. "And after that," said Cineas, "we will vanquish Africa. After Africa, we will go on to Asia. We will conquer Asia Minor, Arabia. And after that," first, "after that, we will go as far as India. After India?" "Ah," said Pyrrhus, "I will rest." And then Cineas says, "Why don't I just take a nap now, man? Why not just rest now?" Yeah, it's a comedic story. Okay, so it is so easy to make things look absurd. That's kind of what the comedian does. They show you the absurdity of situations. And then they paint experiences in this kind of humorous color, as it were. And then that's how you see. It's a way of taking up one's facticity. You know, oh, somebody just slipped out a banana peel. That's what happened. That's the factuality of it. Well, I'm going to look at that and laugh. That's absurd. That kind of thing. Again, it has its place, but it's not, it's kind of a one-dimensional way to look at things. No different than how the cynic looks at things. It just says, who cares? Why try? What's the point? You know, fuck people like that. Okay, and oftentimes comedians are cynical. That's not an accident. You might say some of the best are cynical. I mean, nihilism, nothing. That the most popular show comedy in the last, I don't know, 15 years was Seinfeld. It was a show about nothing. About very superficial people. Okay. It is so easy to make things look absurd. What is the trick here? Well, Cineas takes a series of goals, which Pyrrhus lists one after another, and interprets them as if Pyrrhus intended to do all of them in order to eventually rest. In order to accomplish the last. Since it is so easy to do the last, why go through the trouble of all the rest? I mean, you see, there's two more examples that are probably even more salient that I came up with here. Is the tennis player absurd to hit a ball in order for somebody to send it back to him? So Cineas would say, why do you keep hitting the ball back? It doesn't come right back to you. Similarly, isn't the skier absurd to climb a slope if all he's going to do is immediately come back down? But of course we know there's more to it than that. Again, that's the comedic piece. I do want to talk about comedian just a little bit more briefly. And I'll just read it out loud. Let's consider the comedian in a bit more in depth for a moment. Life is no joke. I think that's the point. The comedian is nihilistic insofar as he enucleates. Makes the nucleus the vibrancy of life by reducing all of life or experiences to a punchline. He accomplishes this by objectifying experiences, which affords him a scientific-like distance from lived experience, where we're making choices but not deliberating them. And so this too is a mode of facticity, a taking up of one's circumstances, albeit in a way that is in bad faith. For again, life cannot be whittled down to a punchline, regardless of how telling or truthful a punchline is, or can be. Okay, so that's what I just did there is talk about nihilism, and how nihilists, cynics, jokesters, comedians, who really kind of see all of life through the frame, through the lens of a joke, that is one big way of evading facts. Of saying, well, you know, escaping the responsibility of one has to be free, and then the anguish, sometimes the gut-wrenching anguish that comes with knowing that one's decisions are one's decisions and are one's self entitled. I want to look at another one, a more prevalent one, called the serious man. A more common way of denying the ambiguity of human life is by what Beauvoir calls seriousness. That kind of seems like a good thing, right? Well, we just made fun of comedians, so what does that leave us with? Well, according to Beauvoir, it is more common because we all begin life as children. Now, here's something interesting. she writes, the child's situation is characterized by his finding himself cast into a universe which he has not helped to establish, which has been fashioned without him, and which appears to him as an absolute to which he can only submit. In his eyes, human inventions, words, customs, and values are given as facts, as inevitable as the skies and the trees. Now, so a little kid, yeah, that's the sky, and I have to eat my vegetables. I mean, he doesn't distinguish any difference there, do you see? Maybe you've had children, you can verify this. This means that the world in which he lives is a serious world, since the characteristics of the spirit of seriousness is to consider values as ready-made things. You know? I mean, so for example, picking on your little sister is bad, you will get grounded for it, you'll get coal in your stocking. That is every bit as true to the kid as, when it rains, I get wet. I mean, that's what she means here. This is how children see the world. It's a serious business to a certain extent. I mean, you know, we see kids laughing and playing and stuff like that, but fundamentally speaking, they know better. They know they're going to do this. Certain circumstances will arise that are unfavorable for them, and so they take it very seriously. You know, they're afraid of that kind of thing. Okay. The child takes his parents to be the divinities, which they vainly try to be. And he thinks that he, too, has being in a definite and substantial way. He is a good little boy, or a scamp, or a scoundrel. And he enjoys being it. Right? The good little boy is happy when he's making his parents happy. Because his, you know, mommy and daddy for him are like the be-all end-all. Their word is truth itself. Okay. Typically, this solid... Let's see, pinch the cheek, good boy. Okay, this solid, comfortable world... You know, why is it comfortable? Because the rules are clear. I do what mommy tells me to do, and I don't do what she tells me not to do. If I follow the rules, I'm a good boy, and I enjoy being a good boy. And if the neighbor... her boy across the street is breaking the rules, he's a bad boy. You don't want to be that. Okay. This comfortable world develops cracks during adolescence. The teenager discovers his subjectivity. He discovers that of others. He notices the contradictions among adults, as well as their hesitations and weaknesses. Men stop appearing as if they were gods. And at the same time, the adolescent discovers the human character of the reality about himself. Language, customs, ethics, and values have their source in those uncertain creatures. So mommy and daddy, you know, they think they know what's best. And they want you to think that. But as a kid grows older, he realizes, you know, mommy and daddy have flaws. And if they're flawed, then maybe they don't know what's best. It's the premise of so many sitcoms. The moment has come when he, too, is going to be called upon to participate in their operation. His actions weigh upon the earth as much as those of any other man. He will have to choose and decide for himself. I mean, so, you know, it's just that situation where he catches mommy kissing Santa Claus or something like that. Where it dawns on the kid that, you know, I've been living my entire life based upon what mom and dad tell me is a good way to live, is a good way to behave in a bad way. And now I see them maybe not following their own rules. So then why should I be so quick to listen to them? They don't, it's like they don't know everything. But if I can't listen to them, who do I listen to? And it's a very big moment in the development of somebody. The adolescent finds himself cast into a world that is no longer ready-made. He discovers his freedom, but finds that it's a mixed blessing. While there is joy in his liberation, okay, when the kid finally realizes, I can make decisions on my own, there's much confusion too. He is abandoned, unjustified. He is the prey of a freedom that is no longer chained up by anything. Freedom is then revealed, but he must decide his attitude in the face of it. I get facticity. Oh my God, I have to make my own decisions. I can't just listen to mom anymore. Because childhood conceals freedom. A man will all his life, and here's where we get this serious, man. A man will all his life long be nostalgic for the time when he did not know of freedom's demands and anxieties. What happens often enough is that, afraid of his freedom, afraid of having to choose and make himself, forge his own identity, a man takes refuge again in the serious world. Well, how so? The serious man gets rid of his freedom by claiming to subordinate it to values which would be unconditioned. So he can no longer revel in mommy and daddy's kind of value system. But he longs to return to that kind of a situation, that kind of an arrangement. And so he seeks out other avenues where he can play the same kind of game. I mean, look, it's not, do I have to spell it? She's picking out religion. So, okay, it's a lot easier for me if I just know, okay, if I want to be a good person, I have to please God. And if I have to do that, I just follow the Ten Commandments. I don't have to make any choices, is what she's saying. She's not saying, she's not picking on all religious people. She's saying, but there are some people who live like this. The unreflective, the kind of casual Christian, isn't it? Who?
Just FYI, you're like 40.
Oh, okay. Well, am I over time?
You can wrap up. But
oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, let me wrap up. I apologize for that. Yeah, that's right. I definitely hear your questions. Listen. Let me try to sum up 9 pages in 9 seconds. She goes through these various possibilities of what she'll boil down to is cowardice. She talks about an adventurer. The adventurer is the kind of guy who throws caution to the wind. He seizes the day. There's something really neat about this guy. Maybe we know people like him. But the problem with the adventurer is that he doesn't really have concern for other people. And he's also content with the way things are if the circumstances tend to benefit him and him alone. You know, so maybe the rich are taxing the poor, we could say, or something like that. The adventurer is not going to care if he is a rich guy and he's being funded so he can go on his voyages. She also she sees the tyrant in the adventurer. You could call somebody like Hitler an adventurer. Because he has a project, he sets out to execute it. And that's what's driving him. But obviously he's committing atrocities. And he doesn't seem to recognize that. Or doesn't seem to care. There's one other as well. Let me cut to the chase here then. There are various ways of avoiding one's freedom. So how are you supposed to live? Right? What's the upshot here? What is the existentialist hero, as it were? It's the person who... Well, it's the person who doesn't deny his or her ambiguity. Who recognizes all of those various things we talked about at the beginning. Who doesn't seek to run from one's freedom, but embraces it and uses it to create value. Is aware of the fact that any project I might have, any goal I might want to realize, that's finite too. That's not going to last forever, just like I'm not going to last forever. But while I'm here on Earth, my life will have meaning. And, you know, if, for example, you choose to adhere to any kind of tradition that's already crafted meaning and what this and that is, what is significant, what is worth living for and dying for, before you got here, and you choose to kind of acquiesce to it, that's okay, so long as you've really given it thought. There's nothing wrong with that. The point being that those, say, commandments or what have you, they don't mean anything. Unless they mean something to you. I mean, that's the point. You are the one who provides meaning in this world. It comes from you. And it comes from the projects that you set up for yourselves. The endeavors that you hope to one day accomplish. That's how you live ethically. And you do so in such a way where you never try to truncate the freedom of other people. And when that is happening, that's what she calls evil. All right. I mean, I guess I could keep going, but I'd rather hear questions from you guys. All right. So thanks for that. Spent a lot of time on context.
Correct. We may have time for one or two. We do need to let the restaurant close up, starting in about another 7 or 8 minutes. So, yes, sir.
I forget who said it, but it's a very strong three-word argument that we really are over here on the deterministic, situational, and not radical freedom.
Right.
Yeah. It's also the three words that scare me the most. Character is destiny. I think that should scare a lot of people, but to the degree that character is persistent, we're really doomed by having been born the person that we are. Any thoughts?
Yeah, Beauvoir would say there's absolutely nothing to that whatsoever. it's utter malarkey. And anybody who finds comfort in that thought is a coward. There's nothing, and she means nothing, determining you. The only thing that might be determining the trajectory your life takes, your character as it forms, would be if you, again, facticity, if you looked at your circumstances and said, there's nothing I can do. I'm going to lose my temper. I'm an Italian. My father lost his temper. My grandpa Nunzio lost his temper. And that's just how I am. Nothing I can do about it. Again, lies.
Okay. Yes, John?
Okay. Back to your phrase a moment ago.
Yes. Beauvoir's phrase. Okay. This is not what I think. I want to make sure that's perfectly clear. This is what Beauvoir thinks.
Whoops.
That's okay.
Okay. Back to the phrase, the invitation to embrace the world.
Yeah.
And go forth to create meaning. But I'm thinking at the same time, in art, there's the issue of the controversy. Is art something that we create,
yes,
or is there an element of cognition that we give it, that we acknowledge something that is beyond us, in
right,
a sense? And this is not to suggest pre-existential. In fact, I would think that it's commensurate with existential approach.
I think so.
Is there not a sense in which embracing the world is also has to embrace this element of cognition that we're born into a world that does have meaning, not a priori meaning necessarily.
That's the key distinction, is that she doesn't want to say there's a priori meaning. But that there is meaning there. But it's only there insofar as that's where you are. That's where you are. Put it this way. There's that old thing, if a tree falls in a woods and no one's there to hear it, does it make a sound? Beauvoir might say, if there's such a thing as planet Earth and there aren't any humans, does it mean anything? And the answer is no. I like to be part of art because, again, they're taking their cue off Nietzsche. Nietzsche said famously, the only way to justify existence, and what he means by that is the only way to create meaning, to make it manifest, is to live your life like a work of art. Beauvoir is right on board with that.
But I guess, again, another way of putting the question, but in commensuration with the world, are in aggression?
Not aggression. Thank you. Definitely in commensuration with the world.
And I think there's a great difference between the two.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Frequently people in the existential movement in France, like Sartre and Beauvoir and Malraux and people like that, were frequently associated with the left, with Marxism. I think Sartre was even in the French Communist Party. It seems from your discussion of at least Beauvoir's opinions, existentialism is highly consistent with a lot of other political opinions that would be more on the right, maybe even the free market right, where you're stuck in certain situations, but you have choices you can make.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm wondering what you think of that outlook.
Yeah, I mean, well, you're absolutely right, sir. So, there was a journal that was created by three prominent philosophers, Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, and Maurice Merleau-Ponty, called The Modern Times. And that was to, I guess for lack of a better term, push the communist movement, I guess. But they also quickly became disenchanted with communism as well, to a certain extent. Sartre kind of went more into it, and Beauvoir kind of backed away from it, which might in and of itself be telling. Yeah, I don't think that, put it this way, existentialism, it was sympathetic for communism for a certain reason, and that is that when she was writing her works, World War II was happening. I mean, France was being overthrown by this, you know, by a very evil establishment. And she said, she thought that kind of the problem with that was because people were buying into it unquestioningly. And I mean, you have Jews who are Nazis, you know? And that's what worried her. And the left at the time was the one who was trying to watch out for that. And so she kind of wanted to side with that. But yeah, I mean, look, it doesn't... To be existentialist in this sense, it doesn't align itself with any particular party. I mean, these are tenets that, I mean, that's, again, it's much more individual than it is political, but you can take the tenets of existentialism and apply it to who you are and how you take up certain political parties, movements, and advances. Yeah, I would agree with that.
This is your last question
here. I have a very basic question.
Yeah.
Is freedom the byproduct of choice, or is choice the byproduct of freedom?
Yeah.
You don't have choice, you see, or you said three.
Don't, yeah. I mean, it's best not to think in terms of cause and effect here. They're one in the same. I mean, one's freedom, I'll say this, the source of one's freedom is one's rational capacity. That's how they understand it. It's the fact that we think and act, and we can do that. But there are plenty of people who think and act, but you want to call them free? And that's the worst point, is that people who take up, who inherit their tradition and then don't ever take a critical stance on it, even for a moment, those people aren't free. They freely surrender their freedom to the machine, or, you know, something like that. That is not free. So you know, does freedom come from free choice? Does choice come from freedom? I mean, false dichotomies. It's they are one and the same thing. When you make an action, you've done so of your own accord. And if you're coerced into actions that you would rather not do, again, that's what she calls evil. Because she really believes that this ability to choose, this necessity to choose, that is the core of human dignity. Alright, one last thing before everybody leaves. Again, I'm here representing the University of Dallas. I don't know if you people are aware of it, but I see, I mean, you know, well, this awesome group here is aware of it, but we have a publication that we put out from our academic, an academic journal from our graduate school. They usually go for $10 a pop. I have a bunch of them here for free. You guys can just take them if you want them. Yeah, you can have as many. I don't know how many I have, but there's, you know, we're about to publish. I'm an associate editor. They're publishing a piece by me this fall. But we've got about four of them under our belt, and it comes out once a year. And if you want to subscribe, you can go online and subscribe if you want, but I've got a few of them here. It's interdisciplinary, so you have stuff on Dante, Augustine, Shakespeare. Dr. Wood has a little something on here on Nietzsche and the Phenomenology of Prayer, which is an excellent piece. All the big heavy hitters of Western civilization in a way that's not overly technical. And that's how we like it. That's why when I heard about this, I was like, oh, this is just perfect in line with what we do at UD here. So, yeah, I mean, I've got a bunch of them here. Feel free to help yourself. You're kind enough to invite me here. I'm happy to give away these for free. All right, thanks, guys. I had a good time.